Welcome to another edition of Mormonland. I'm managing editor Dave Noyce, and I oversee our faith coverage. I'm joined by senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher-Stack. Hello, Peggy.
Hi, Dave.
When 9 U.S. citizens were killed in a brutal attack in northern Mexico last week, much of the world learned for the first time about that area's prevailing ties to Mormon polygamy. Those ties include a complex cast of characters and creeds, both mainstream Latter-day Saints and breakaway believers. Here to help us untangle and understand this web is historian Barbara Jones Brown, executive director of the Mormon History Association, who has studied and written about post-1890 Mormon plural marriage. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you here. Oh, let's start with a sort of a precursor of what just happened. What are the biggest misconceptions in regards to Mormon polygamy about the recent killings of the 3 mothers and 6 children in Mexico? What are the biggest misconceptions you're seeing?
Well, I think it's important to point out about those who were affected by this horrible tragedy that not all of them were necessarily polygamous. Not all of them were believers in Latter-day Saint doctrine. Some are members of other churches. It's a very diverse area. For example, I have a friend who's a Mennonite preacher who lives in one of these colonies of northern Mexico. And so it's important to point out that this is a diverse group and not paint everyone as belonging to one group.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back now, just for our listeners to get grounded in this. When did Latter-day Saints first start practicing polygamy, and why did they?
So they started practicing polygamy in the early 1840s in Nauvoo after the prophet and first president of the church, Joseph Smith, received a revelation in 1843, which is now appears as Section 132 in the Doctrine and Covenants. So Smith had been practicing polygamy privately before that, but it kind of started to go public among some members, particularly leaders of the church, in the early 1840s. This practice grows as the Latter-day Saints come to Utah, and they first go public with the fact that they're practicing polygamy as a religious tenet in 1852.
And why did they? What's the reason stated that they did it?
Well, there's all kinds of theories and so forth, but it was taught that in order to receive the highest, achieve the highest degree of the celestial kingdom in post-life, that you had to practice this. It was considered a sacrifice, something that would be very difficult to live, as you can imagine it was, particularly, I think, for women. But it was preached as a religious tenet that this is something that early prophets of the Old Testament had practiced, and therefore this is something that God wanted them to practice as well.
And so what did other people in the U.S. think at the time?
So when it was publicly announced in 1852, there was an uproar about it because most of the United States was monogamous, and they valued monogamy. And so there was a lot of surprise and outrage about this, which escalated, culminating in the 1880s when the federal government passed laws that criminalized polygamy.
And so how did Mormons or members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints come to settle in Mexico, or at least some of them?
Right. So as I mentioned, when Congress started passing these acts that criminalized polygamy, Latter-day Saints started to flee from Utah. Polygamous Latter-day Saints started to leave Utah, where there was territorial marshals, federal marshals were hunting down polygamists and putting them into prison. So they left Utah and started to go outside of Utah to places like Colorado, Wyoming, Arizona, Alberta, Canada, and northern Mexico. So in the mid-1880s, that's when Latter-day Saints started establishing colonies in Chihuahua, Mexico.
Was it illegal there? Was it legal?
Yes, polygamy was illegal in Mexico. And so when the first polygamous families started arriving in Chihuahua in the mid-1880s, local officials were trying to evict them. But LDS leaders, namely Apostles Erastus Snow and Helaman Pratt was not an apostle. He was the president of the Mexican mission. They met with federal leaders in Mexico City of the Mexican government and made their case. They said, look, we just want to come here in peace. We want to develop farmlands and help contribute to Mexico's economy. And ultimately what happens is the federal officials in Mexico say, okay, if you will live your marriage practices quietly, we'll look the other way so that you can come in and help us develop our economy in the ways that you described. And so after that, Latter-day Saints started pouring into these areas, several thousand, particularly after 1890, when Wilford Woodruff, the president at the time, made a statement, a declaration that the church would no longer practice polygamy in Utah Territory. It's very important if you
worded.
Look at that, very carefully worded. So what happens in 1890, why that declaration comes out is, I mentioned that Congress passed some acts criminalizing polygamy. One passed in 1887 was called the Edmunds-Tucker Act, and this meant that not only adherence to the LDS Church, but also the church itself was held responsible for practicing polygamy. And so the federal government was able to confiscate the church's properties, including its temples. The church put forth a test case to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that the 1887 Edmunds-Tucker Act was constitutional. That ruling came out in May 1890. Mm-hmm. And so in the very next General Conference of the Church in October, that's when Wilford Woodruff makes this official declaration, or as it's colloquially referred to, the manifesto, saying, okay, we're not practicing this in Utah Territory or in our temples here. But what he doesn't mention is that polygamy is continuing to grow in these colonies, these Mormon colonies, in northern Mexico and in Canada. And so the church encouraged any polygamous families who were facing prosecution or any who wanted to enter into polygamy to move to these areas where they would not be prosecuted.
So the church's role in this, you know, were they allowing them to go to Mexico? You say encouraging. Were they assigning any to go to Mexico?
No, they were not assigning any to go. They were just encouraging those polygamous families who were living in Utah and in the United States to avoid prosecution to move to Mexico, and there they could continue to live their religious tenets and keep their families intact in peace without fear of prosecution.
But with the church's blessing, obviously.
With the church's blessing and knowledge. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that one of the misconceptions of the current media about the Mexico killings last week, which is that somehow these Mexican Latter-day Saints were running away from the church,
right,
as opposed to actually being kind of encouraged or endorsed by the church?
Yes, exactly. There's a misperception, even among some historians, that the folks that went to northern Mexico were fleeing the 1890 edict or fleeing the church's authority and doing it in defiance of the church's authority, which is just not the case. They were going because at the encouragement of the church so that they could, again, practice polygamy without fear of prosecution. So these were actually extremely faithful members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who were living the what they considered to be and what they were taught to be the highest tenets of the church, making incredible sacrifices. They gave up so much to go to Mexico so that they could continue to practice polygamy.
So did the church really give up polygamy in 1890?
In the United States and in Utah, but really it was going on much smaller numbers than the majority, but it was continuing. So it took a second manifesto.
Explain a little bit about that, Barbara. What happens that finally essentially eliminates it from the mainstream church?
So you have, again, as I mentioned, so these colonies or these communities in Canada and northern Mexico are growing. And in 1904, an apostle, an LDS apostle named Reed Smoot, is elected to the Senate. And some non LDS folks in Utah write to Congress and say, look, this apostle was just made a senator, but you need to know that the LDS Church, some of its members are still practicing polygamy. And they send this to Congress. Congress gets a word of it, and so they hold hearings, Senate hearings, which is kind of timely today. but they hold Senate hearings on Apostle Reed Smoot and the LDS Church,
whether to
basically
allow him to serve as a senator.
Whether to seat him.
And he was not polygamous.
Even though he was monogamous, but they go after the LDS Church and the fact that many of its members are still, with the church's blessing, practicing polygamy. And these hearings continue for 3 years. So ultimately, he is seated, but it becomes this big national uproar throughout the United States that, oh my gosh, they are still practicing polygamy. How do we put an end to this?
And at the time, wasn't it, the church president was Joseph F. Smith, and
exactly,
he was polygamous.
Yes, he was a polygamist.
Kind of exhibit A.
Yeah, so there is that.
Yeah. So by this time, Joseph F. Smith, who is Joseph Smith's nephew, is the president of the church. And so Smoot comes to him, and Franklin Richards, who is a church attorney, they come to Joseph F. Smith and convince him that he has to do something to redress the church's damaged reputation. And so at this time, he issues what is called colloquially the Second Manifesto in 1904. And this says, it doesn't explicitly point out Mexico or Canada, but it does say that anyone that continues to practice polygamy will be excommunicated from the church. And that's when that policy started, and it continues to stand today. But Smith, Joseph F. Smith, goes to Mexico in 1905, and at a meeting of a stake priesthood meeting, he tells the men there, look, we're not even practicing it down here anymore. That is to say, do not enter into any new polygamous marriages. From this point forward, he says, the church is under scrutiny at this time, and we have to be very careful, are the words he uses. He admonishes the men, continue to take care of the families that you have. So don't throw off your wives and children that are polygamous. Continue to take care of them, but do not enter into any new polygamous marriages. So that's what really ends it, although there are still continue to be even LDS-sanctioned polygamous marriages that continue, but they're very, very small in number.
And so ultimately, what made most of the Mormons, including Mitt Romney's relatives, leave Mexico?
So in from 1910 to 1920, the Mexican Revolution breaks out. And these are where you hear the legendary stories of Pancho Villa and other Mexican revolutionaries changing what Mexico looks like at the time. Much of the revolutionary violence takes place in northern Mexico, and some of the revolutionaries want to drive out any of the immigrants who came from the United States or from Europe to invest in and to live in northern Mexico. They want to drive them out. It's so ironic, I think, because you have hear these Mexicans saying, get these immigrants out of here. We don't want you here. Mexico is for Mexicans, and the United States is for the gringos, is the terms that are being spoken in speeches by these revolutionaries. So you have all these revolutionary factions fighting the federal government and amongst themselves. So there's quite a bit of violence. And many of these Mormon colonies in northern Mexico, they're resource rich. They've developed these beautiful farms with a lot of food. And so these revolutionaries need this food. And so they'll come through and take everything from the Latter-day Saints settlers there. Church leaders in Salt Lake City admonish the Latter-day Saint emigrants to not take any sides and to be neutral so as to avoid facing any violence. But eventually, it gets so bad, and when revolutionary soldiers tell the Mormons they have to turn over their guns and ammunition. That's when they decide we've got to leave. So in 1912, there is this mass exodus from the Latter-day Saint colonies, including the Romney family. Mm-hmm. George Romney was, this is Mitt Romney's father, George, was 5 years old at the time. His parents were monogamous, but his grandparents were polygamous. They all leave, and most of them leave for the United States, never to return.
So George was born in Mexico, right?
Yes. In okay. fact, I've been in the house where he was born and raised. Okay. It's a beautiful home down there.
So eventually, though, polygamous from breakaway groups start going to Mexico, correct?
Right. So what happens is you have about 10% of those who fled during these exoduses. There are actually three different times where people flee and go back to the United States because of violence. There's all the same things that happen today. There's kidnappings. There's robbery. Anyways, some of them keep coming back because when they go to the United States, they realize that they can't live as polygamous families because of prosecution. And they're ostracized by members of their own church who have been monogamous now for quite some time. And these monogamous members don't realize that these polygamous members have been in Mexico with the church's blessing. It's really a sad, sad story. So anyways, those that keep coming back, it's because they're avoiding that ostracism and prosecution in spite of the horrible violence they face. So these folks stay there. Most of them adhere to the Latter-day Saint leaders' edicts, and they do not enter into new polygamous marriages, and their children continue to stay there and grow up monogamous. But you do have some Latter-day Saints who don't agree with the church's edict to end polygamy, and some of those folks continue to practice polygamy. They either form their own churches, their own groups, or they might just continue to practice polygamy as just families who still believe in the church, but they think, well, the church has gone astray. We're going to continue to practice this. The Lemora settlement was founded in 1960, so that came much later. And again, it's a group of all different kinds of people. But yes, you have some families who even came from the United States in the 1920s who start colonies in Mexico who want to continue to practice polygamy.
Now, our reporter, Nate Carlisle, who covers polygamy for the Tribune, noted in his stories, and we talked about when he came back, what you just mentioned, that most of the people down there, first of all, most of them aren't polygamous, although they believe in it, but they don't really belong to any certain church.
Exactly.
And I know a lot of media originally got some of that a little wrong. Maybe you could talk about kind of the LeBaron link that was kind of reported and help dispel some of that.
Right. So I think some of the confusion came from the fact that some of these folks who were living in Lemora have the last name of
LeBaron,
but that doesn't necessarily mean they're a member of a church that Irvin LeBaron started.
The Church of the Firstborn or whatever it was
exactly.
called.
Exactly. Yes. And my friend Christina Rossetti, who's an expert on this, and Lindsay Hanson Park, who are experts on this aspect, talk about this. But Irvin LeBaron had several sons, and some of them started their own churches as well. And so really, you've got all kinds of factions, all kinds of different groups. I understand that there's more than 400 break-off churches or groups that trace their origins to Joseph Smith. So we just have to be really careful about not lumping everybody into one group.
So you describe these people as not necessarily polygamist and not necessarily religious or belonging to a church, but do many of them still have some sort of ties to Mormonism? Mormonism with a big umbrella?
I'm not an expert on that, so I don't want to comment.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me go to another area, Barbara. That's the fact, and you mentioned this, that the mainstream LDS church still teaches polygamy, at least theologically, right? It's part of its theology. Does that complicate the issue?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that the mainstream Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints still teaches polygamy.
Right, but it's part of their teachings.
But the fact of the matter is, it is in the Doctrine and Covenants, Section 132, which is canonized scripture. And so that is problematic, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so famously, the new church, relatively new church president for the mainstream, for lack of a better word, LDS Church, President Russell M. Nelson, 18, 20 months ago, launched a major push that the church is going full bore on of eliminating the use of the word Mormon as a nickname mm-hmm. for the church. And a lot of people point to this confusion that happens, especially in regards to polygamy, as maybe one of the motivating factors for this. How do you see that?
That could be a motivating factor. I do not know. I can't speak for him or what was in his mind, but I've wondered if that's perhaps one factor. I also think perhaps another reason why is because the word Mormon doesn't translate well in outside of the United States in other languages. And as the church continues to grow, mostly out in Africa and other mm-hmm. places outside the United States, I think there's a desire to get away from that. For example, I served a mission for the LDS Church in Japan, and the way you say Mormon is Moromon, which rhymes with hormone in Japanese. And so people in Japan would always say, oh, hormone, Moromon, you know. So it just, it doesn't translate. So I don't know. I can't speak for the church, of course, but... the church has always, it's in its scripture, in the Book of Mormon, it says we are not the Mormon church. If the church is called by any person's name, then it is that person's church. So if it is called Moses' church, then it's Moses' church, but we're the Church of Jesus Christ. And so the church has never liked to be called the Mormon church. So I think there's another effort to get away from using that. I used to work for the church magazines, and in the 1990s, there was the same push to get away from calling it the Mormon church. But if you look at the church's style guide, it's okay to call Latter-day Saints Mormons as well. Preferably, they're called Latter-day Saints.
How does Latter-day Saint translate in Japanese? Or does it?
Matsujitsu Seito.
Oh.
Latter-day Saints. So, yeah, okay, that translates. Okay. So I think it's just another push to get away from using that. So you mentioned I'm executive director of the Mormon History Association, and the reason why we are not changing our name is because we are not the History Association of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. That is one of the churches whose history we study, but we study the past of all churches or groups, faiths that trace their origins to Joseph Smith, and therefore we're not the History Association of any one church. Therefore, we can't change our name because it would be inaccurate.
And as you said, if there are 400 groups that track back to church founder Joseph Smith, then Mormonism is more connects to all those groups.
Absolutely. That's right.
Correct.
But does make it difficult when these things happen.
It does.
For the mainstream church.
You can see why it's confusing for everyone, both members of the mainstream church and members of the media and others, because people of these offshoots, these breakoff groups, if you will, they refer to themselves as Mormons mm-hmm. as well. So it is. Mm-hmm. It can be very confusing. I really understand why people can get this wrong.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like it would take a long time to change the dynamic on that, if it ever can be. I mean, as far as the confusion that could happen to people. Is there anything else in what is going on down in Mexico? Because you see a lot of families leaving now,
yes,
of course.
Yes.
Now our stories have pointed out that not everybody is, because some of these have successful farming operations.
Yeah.
You can't just
pack
up and leave. So as you're looking at and what you've written, does it seem like I've seen this rodeo before?
Yes.
In other words,
tell
us kind of what you think about
that. It's been absolutely fascinating to me, because I wrote about, as I mentioned, these families facing this very difficult decision of whether or not to leave behind their farms, their homes, everything they worked their whole lives to develop, essentially most of what they have, facing that difficult decision to leave that behind. And again, return to the United States, and those who are polygamous, many of them gave up polygamy, gave up their polygamous families, had to live, they couldn't live together as families anymore, or continue to face the violence. So that was happening here in the 1910s, and here it is happening again. As I read the stories of the folks who are now making the difficult decision of whether or not to leave Lemora settlement or not, they're saying the exact same things. And so it's heartbreaking, because when I studied these historic stories, it was gut-wrenching to read about these folks and then to see a whole new group of people going through it again. It's really heartbreaking.
Are there still some communities in northern Mexico that trace their origins to the LDS Church, like in Chihuahua,
yes,
other places, who
yes
might still be polygamists or at least still practice a form of Mormonism?
So that are polygamists, that are practicing polygamy?
Or not, you know, are
yeah
there still people that consider themselves Mormon even though their ancestors were polygamists, but maybe they're not, but they still...
Yeah, so the only two colonies that survived, the Mormon colonies in Mexico that survived the Mexican Revolution, are Colonia Juarez
okay
and Colonia Dublan. And those two communities, they're still descendants of these early Latter-day Saints who are mainstream LDS, who are monogamous and follow the church, the mainstream
oh
church, who still live there. In fact, that's where President Hinckley announced the first small temple that would be built, President Gordon B. Hinckley of the LDS Church. It was after visiting Colonia Juarez and the faithful members of the mainstream church at that time, and he knew of their history and the sacrifices that had been made there, but the population was still so small, he regretted that he couldn't build a temple down there. And he received a revelation after that point that led to the building of hundreds, dozens, I don't know if we're hundreds yet, dozens of smaller temples. And so Colonia Juarez Temple was the one that inspired that. So,
and are those folks facing any violence from?
Not that I'm aware of at this time.
Okay.
But it is tenuous territory.
But I'm sure
yes
it is tenuous mm-hmm for them. And
yeah,
I'm sure if I spoke to them, I'd probably, you know, after the last few weeks, I'd probably hear a different story.
Well, I know you can't predict the future, but let me just ask you this anyway.
So predict the future, Barbara.
Do you think most of them are going to end up leaving? I mean, what's your thought? I don't know if you've, like you say, you haven't communicated with them and don't know. Do you have any idea? What you think might happen?
I don't know.
What percentage
historians
left
are not supposed to predict the future.
What percentage left in 1912?
What percent? So 90% of those who were practicing polygamy left and never came back. So
So if the same thing repeats itself,
if it did, yeah,
then you know mm-hmm there'd be very few left in Lemora.
Right. Yeah, so I don't know about those who were in Chihuahua, and I have friends there, so I should talk to them and find out what their future holds.
It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Okay, Barbara, can you just tell us some places where our listeners could read more about this, the colonies in Mexico and their connection to Mormonism?
Sure. For this aspect of this story, I've published my work in two different books. One is in a book called The Persistence of Polygamy, Fundamentalist Mormon Polygamy from 1890 to the Present. It's published by John Whitmer Books and edited by Newell Bringhurst and Craig Foster. I also published my work about the Mexican Revolution and its effect on the colonies in a book called Just South of Zion, The Mormons in Mexico and Its Borderlands. It's edited by Jason Dormady and Jared Tamez and published by University of New Mexico Press. Both of these books came out in 2015.
And we should mention that Barbara wrote a fascinating column on this subject for Religion News Service that we have posted at sltrib.com. They can read, and along with a piece by Lindsay Hanson Park, who Barbara mentioned, that also explains about this. You can also find it at sltrib.com. Barbara Jones Brown, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks to Peggy Fletcher Stack.
Always a pleasure.
And to our producer, Chris Samuels, thank you. We remind our listeners that they can keep up on all the happenings in and about the church by subscribing to our free weekly newsletter. Just go to sltrib.com to sign up, and we'll talk again next week on Mormonland.